Please turn with me to the book of Proverbs, chapter 13. The book of Proverbs, chapter 13. Last week, we arrived at verse 24, and I've just a thought or two about this verse. Proverbs 13, verse 24 says, "He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly." That word promptly means do it seasonably, as early as possible, and then it also means after that it is to be left behind. It is something with discipline that parents have to learn, that once they've disciplined their children, they forget it. Forget it. Don't keep harping on it. Don't keep throwing it up in their faces. Don't keep reminding them, this is what you did at such and such a time, a week ago or a month ago or a year ago. Promptly and finally, it ought to be the case when correcting our children. Do it and have done with it. And so we come to verse 25, the last verse of this 13th chapter. "The righteous eats to the satisfying of his soul, but the stomach of the wicked shall be in want." Here is godly satisfaction. The righteous eats to the satisfying of his soul. By the righteous is meant the believer who may be hungry, as Psalm 34 puts it in verse 10. Psalm 34 and verse 10. "The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing." This is what Solomon says too in the book of Proverbs. As a famous preacher once said, "Lions lacking, but the children satisfied." The 13th chapter of the book of Proverbs, verse 25, tells us this. He eats to the satisfying of his soul. Now, for him to be a righteous man who eats means that he not only is a believer, but the way he eats and what he eats and how much he eats is also important. When Shaul wrote to the believers in Corinth, he said, "Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." And he can do this. He can eat as much as he really needs, but not to excess. Our Lord Yeshua referred to the danger of overeating, overdrinking. In Luke chapter 21, verse 34. Luke chapter 21, verse 34. "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." Very important, the way we eat. For a believer, to be guzzling is a disgrace to his master. But when a believer eats just as much as he needs and eats at least in a decent manner, then he shows he honors God by his action. So a holy life here means also holiness in the most practical and the most basic things in life, not to the surfeiting, but to the satisfying of the appetite. Again in the Psalms, Psalm 37 and verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on His faithfulness. That is a promise that they will be satisfied. But this also refers to spiritual satisfaction. Physical satisfaction, yes, but also spiritual satisfaction. The righteous eateth to the satisfying of his soul. The Lord Yeshua put it like this in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they which hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. That is spiritual appetite. And the Lord is very pleased to meet our spiritual appetites and to satisfy them. But in Ecclesiastes 5, we read verses 18 through 20, what it means to eat and to drink to the satisfying of the body. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18 to 20. There is a sense in which that saying is true. Eat, drink, and be merry. Here's how Solomon put it. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. That is, we acknowledge that this is the life that God has given us. We are stewards of this life. We are to take care of this body that God has given us. But we must do it in a way that honors God. We do not honor God when we overeat and we bring indigestion or trouble, digestive problems upon ourselves. Solomon goes on to say in verse 19 and 20 of Ecclesiastes 5, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. When we do everything with a view to the honor of God, then we may eat and we may drink and we may rejoice. So there is legitimate eating and drinking. But the converse of this is the second half of verse 25. But the stomach of the wicked shall be in want. And by the stomach here is meant the innermost being of the wicked shall be in want. That is, shall crave, shall lack. The innermost being of the wicked person. In the Bible we read about those whose God is their belly, who mind earthly things. This is what is meant here too. The stomach of the wicked shall be in want. Those that can never have enough. In Isaiah chapter 28, God describes this attitude and the evil fruits of it. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 7 and 8. But they also have erred through wine, and through intoxicating drink are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that no place is clean. Overeating, the result is that they threw up what they ate. The stomach of the wicked shall be in want. They shall crave, but they shall lack. In the book of Job, we read about this. Job chapter 20, here's a graphic description, and it is a true description, but it was applied by Job's friends to the wrong person. They were making subtle accusations against Job that he was this person, but what they said was true. Job 20, verse 17. He will not see the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. He will restore that for which he labored and will not swallow it down. For from the proceeds of his business he will get no enjoyment, for he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has violently seized the house which he did not build. Because he knows no quietness in his heart, he will not save anything he desires. Nothing is left for him to eat. Therefore his well-being will not last. In his self-sufficiency he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come against him. When he is about to fill his stomach, God will cast on him the fury of his wrath and will rain it on him while he is eating. That's what happened to the people of Israel when they craved flesh. They cried and they said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we ate in Egypt freely, the leeks, the onions, the cucumbers, the garlic." Just as James was reading to us from the book of Numbers. But now our soul is dried up from this worthless bread. They were referring to the manna that God fed them with every day, this worthless bread. As a result, we read, God sent them quails, and God said, "You will eat of them not 1 or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20 days, but a whole month, until it's coming out of your nostrils." Even then they did not take warning, and when God sent the quails, they grabbed them and they slaughtered them and prepared them for a big feast. But we read that while they were eating the quails, God smote them with a great plague. 23,000 of them died as a result of that plague. This is what Solomon says here. The stomach of the wicked shall be in want. While they were yet chewing, while the flesh was between their teeth, God sent judgment to them. By way of a notice, whatever enslaves us, we cannot enjoy. You and I can only enjoy that which we are not enslaved to. Once we become enslaved to anything or to any person, we have lost our freedom, we have lost our ability to enjoy. To enjoy something means that we are able to pick it up and to put it down. That we are able to say, all things are lawful for me, but all things benefit me not. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10. The wise man tells us the same thing there. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. What he's saying here is someone who is addicted to heaping up silver or riches will never have enough. It was said of a rich man in the States, a multimillionaire, that he was asked once, "How much is enough, Mr. So-and-so?" He said, $1 more than I've got." Poor man. It was also said of him that he couldn't eat a hearty meal like the poor people around him. At least they could eat a hearty meal, they could enjoy what they were eating, but he had to feed on dry crackers and water and on poor fare, poor meals. So all his riches did him no good at all. Make sure that what you enjoy does not hold you in bondage. And then you can enjoy legitimately. We come to chapter 14 now, and immediately the focus is on the wife, the homemaker, the mother. Verse 1. Every wise woman builds her house, but the foolish pulls it down with her hands. First of all, every wise woman, the Hebrew is the wisdoms of woman. In other words, a wise woman has multiple wisdom. It's not just, it doesn't flow in one stream, but her wisdom shows itself in myriad ways, multiple wisdom of woman. What is meant by a wise woman? One that has a meek and a quiet spirit, says the Bible, which is in the sight of God of great price. A meek and a quiet spirit. A gracious spirit. Verse 11, chapter 11, verse 16 of Proverbs. A gracious woman retains honor, but ruthless men retain riches. The contrast there is to show us in a vivid form that a gracious woman is more powerful than a soldier, than a warrior, than a ruthless man. Ruthless men retain riches. Nobody dares to attack a heavily armed man when he's guarding his riches. But a gracious woman is even more mighty, morally and spiritually, and she retains honor more powerfully than the heavily armed warrior retains his riches. It shows how powerful a godly woman is in her God-appointed place. A wise can also mean virtuous. Chapter 12, verse 4. We looked at that already. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. When her husband walks down the street, they say, "You know who his wife is, don't you? It's such and such." He has a crown on his head. A crown is something of beauty. She adds dignity to her husband. She adds honor to him. Also, a diligent wife. Chapter 31, verse 27. Chapter 31 of Proverbs, verse 27. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. That is a wise woman, someone who is diligent, who is gracious, who is virtuous, who is also godly. As I mentioned earlier on, a meek and a quiet spirit. In 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. 2 Timothy chapter 1 verse 5. Shaul is writing to Timothy, and he reminds him of the godly legacy he had from his mother and from his grandmother. They were wise and godly women. He says, 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5, "When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. She is godly. Lois was a godly woman. She passed on her godliness to her daughter Eunice. Eunice was married probably to an unbeliever. We don't hear much about him at all, except that he was a Greek. But in spite of the disadvantage she was under, she managed to bring up a young man who proved to be such a help to the Apostle Paul that he said, "He has served with me in the gospel like a son with the Father." That's what a wise woman can do. See how in these ways and in many other ways she shows her multiple wisdom. What does she do? She builds her house. She raises it. She renews it. She repairs it. She brings God's blessing upon it. And by the house is meant not the house of brick and wood and stone, but rather the household, the family. She builds it. She is the builder. With the blessing of God. In Psalm 127, there's a picture there of the godly wife who builds her home. Psalm 120, verse 1. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. The first half of that verse, she builds her house, obviously, under the guidance of God and with the help of God. She seeks God in building the house. One of the most outstanding examples of that is Ruth, the woman from Moab. Let's look back at Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4. Boaz had decided to take her as his wife. He had agreed to take her as his wife. And he says in verse 10 of Ruth chapter 4, "Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day." And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. And may you prosper in Ephrata and be famous in Bethlehem." We know very well the story of Ruth the Moabitess. Naomi had left Bethlehem with her husband and her two sons because of a famine and had gone over to the land of the Moabites. While they were there, her two sons had married, and Mahlon, one of her sons, had married Ruth. He left her a widow. The other son also died and left Ruth's sister-in-law a widow as well. The husband died and left Naomi a widow. So here were three widows, the mother-in-law and the two daughters-in-law. At that point, Naomi, with great grief and great sorrow, decided to return to Bethlehem. And she told her daughters-in-law, "You go back to your own families. Maybe someone else will marry you. But there's no prospect you coming with me." However, Ruth said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, there I will die, and there will I be buried. May God do so and more to me also, if anything but death separates you from me." That was Ruth, her godly resolve to take Naomi's God as her God. Naomi's people as her people. As a result, Boaz, that rich, wealthy relative of hers, the landowner, took notice of her, and he considered it a great honor for him to have such a woman as his wife. And the people blessed him. They said, "You've chosen a virtuous woman." And they said, they pronounced a blessing. "The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two sisters that Jacob married, the two who built the house of Israel." Even today, when on Friday evening, the father returns from the synagogue after evening prayers, he returns to the Shabbat meal, he will bless his wife in these same words: "May God make you like Rachel and like Leah, the two who built the house of Israel." No greater blessing could the rabbis find for the wife, the mother, the homemaker, than to pronounce on her the blessing of Ruth. With the blessing of God, she raises her family. There's a saying, an old saying, "Better is a fortune in a wife than a fortune with a wife." And what is meant by that is that it's better to have your wife as your fortune than just to have a wife and a fortune, but nothing special about that wife. Those of us who have godly wives, we can count it our greatest blessing, our greatest earthly blessing, to have a godly woman for a wife. Alas, the second half of this proverb says, "But the foolish pulls it down with her hands." By foolish is meant ungodly, idle, vain, those that walk around tail-bearing. But alas, and I have to say this, the one who governs with anger. I have seen families completely devastated because the wife rules by rage. If the children cross her wishes, or if the husband seeks to cross her wishes, she flies into a rage. And that way, she has her way. And I've seen the children completely ruined morally and spiritually and even physically because of the rage of the wife and of the mother. The foolish pulls it down with her hands. She tears down this good home of hers. She personally does it. Jezebel was like that. We read about King Ahab, that there was none like him who provoked God to anger, whom his wife Jezebel stirred up. So there is a solemn warning here. How to build the home? By being gracious, by being God-fearing, by being virtuous, by being diligent, but most of all, a meek and a quiet spirit. What a balm it was to be in a home in Alberta where the wife had that meek and quiet spirit. It was a blessing to be in that family as their guest. So we come to chapter 14, verse 2. "He who walks in his uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is perverse in his ways despises him." He who walks in his uprightness means the one who conducts himself. This could well refer to the husband in this case. in chapter 14, verse 1, it is the wife that seems to be in the spotlight. Here in verse 2 is the husband. The father of Samuel, the prophet, was like that. Let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 to 3 tell us the whole story. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Tzophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Yeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Every year he took his whole family up to worship. This was a man who believed in family worship, family altar. If there's anything that's lacking today, it's the family altar. Very few families where the family gets together every day to read the Word of God and to pray together. But that is what the need of the hour is. Why is it that men are so slow to pray in the congregation? Why is it that they don't know how to pray? It's because they've not been brought up to pray. They've not been trained. They are not familiar with the practice of prayer. It starts with the very little ones. Even before they read, you can put their hands together. And I remember my mother doing this for me when we were still in Japan. She would say, put your hands together, and she put her hands over me, over mine. Now say after me, God bless Daddy, God bless Mommy, and so on. She taught me to pray in her tender, loving way. This man, Elkanah, was one who believed in family worship. He went up every year to worship. What was remarkable about it is that the Bible tells us the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Those two men were some of the most ungodly priests of their time. They were the ones that abused their office, that discouraged people from offering sacrifice by their abuse of their privileges, committing adultery with women who came to worship at the tabernacle. And for all that, this man still went up with his family to worship. Why did he do it? He said, that's where the house of God is. I don't go for those ungodly priests. I go there to seek God. And so in spite of those disadvantages, those severe disadvantages, he still took his family up to worship. And it was at the place of worship that Hannah got the answer to her prayers, and God gave her a son, of whom it was said that he was such a godly man. God says of him, when I bring disaster upon my people, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, they would only save their own lives. Samuel was comparable to Moses in godliness and in piety. So there's an example of a man, of the man we read about here, who walks in his uprightness and who fears the Lord, who has genuine piety. That doesn't mean he's without sin. David himself says, I was righteous before the Lord, and then he qualifies it by saying, I kept myself from mine iniquity. I realized that I've got a besetting sin, and I've got to guard against this besetting sin. But at the same time, God sees my efforts and blesses and acknowledges them and rewards them. He walks in his uprightness. I was upright before him, says David. I kept myself from mine iniquity. So the book of Hebrews tells us, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. He fears the Lord. He reveres God. He shows it by the way he thinks, by his thoughts, by his words, by his actions as well. An upright man is known by his fear of God. Nehemiah was an outstanding example. Let's look at chapter 5 of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah was the cupbearer of the emperor of Persia. He'd been given authority to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the city and to be the governor of the people for 12 years. During that time, he says, there were some things I did and there were other things I did not do. Not because I didn't have the privilege or the right, but I renounced my rights for the good of my people. Chapter 5, verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. They didn't ask anybody to give them food for nothing. They bought it. But the former governors who had been before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. Indeed, that's not all, says Nehemiah. I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, he says, there were at my table 150 Jews and rulers besides those who came to us from the nations around us. I didn't ask them to feed me. I fed them. Shaul says the same thing. I had the right, he says to the Corinthians, to be supported of you, but I didn't claim that privilege. I wanted to teach you by example what it means that to work with our own hands to supply the needs of others. Here is a man that walked in his uprightness, that feared the Lord and showed it. Also in chapter 7 of Nehemiah, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 7 of Nehemiah, verses 1 and 2. He mentions someone else who feared God. He says, when at last we'd finished the walls and put up the gates and the bars and the locks, verse 1, then it was when the wall was built and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers and the Levites had been appointed, that I gave the charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Hananiah had this to say about it. What does Hananiah mean? Jehovah is gracious. An upright man fears the Lord. Alas, the converse is true also. The contrast here is presented. But he who is perverse in his ways despises him. That is, he who turns aside from God's ways shows that he despises God. He treats God with contempt. He is perverse. His ways, we read. He who is perverse in his ways. That is to say, in his multiple transgressions. Speaking about the ways of the sinner, that they are many. The way of a saint is one way. The way of a believer is one road. But the ways of the ungodly are many. All we like sheep, says the prophet Isaiah, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That means the ways of sin are myriad, multiple, manifold. You see how many times this word multiple keeps coming up, multiplied. He who is perverse in his ways despises the Lord, treats with contempt, even betrays with a kiss. That's what Judas did. Alas, we have to say here, he who is perverse in his ways despises him, that even some good believers have fallen into the trap of despising God. No less than David. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 9 and 10. God charges David with despising him. David, the sweet singer of Israel, fell badly. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 9 and 10. God says to him through the prophet Nathan, "Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife." Even believers can fall into that snare. They don't live in it. Thank God, David repented of his sin. God forgave his sin. God restored him. But it is possible, even for the child of God, to fall as badly as the worst sinner. We have that traitor within us, as someone described our heart. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And therefore, we have to ask God to keep us and to guard our hearts. Even in the letter to the Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, the warning is there. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 6 to 8. The same warning over the same kind of sin that David fell into. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 6. That no one should take advantage of and defraud his brother in this matter. What is that matter? Lust. Because the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also forewarned you and testified. For God did not call us to uncleanness, but in holiness. Therefore he who rejects this does not reject man, but God, who has also given us his Holy Spirit. He who is perverse in his ways despises him. It can be also some secret sin. Ezekiel the prophet was taken in vision from Babylon, where he was a captive, to Jerusalem. And in chapter 8, he was shown the secret chambers where the elders of Israel were worshipping idols. Outwardly, the elders of Israel were attending the temple courts, offering up sacrifices to the God of Israel. But in their secret chambers, they were worshipping idols, secret sins. God says they put the branch to their nose. It was a gesture of contempt against God. So the warning there is for us to seek to live, to think, to speak to the glory of God, to the honor of God. May God bless His word to our hearts.